From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for January 24th, 2020. Legendary comedian Jerry Seinfeld is at the Riverside Theater tonight for two shows. And how about this? This Sunday, it's the Coffee and Donut Festival at Turner Hall. A lot of cops will show up for that, I'm sure. And the Bucks have a couple of home games this week with the Wizards and the Nuggets. All right, I've got three goofy stories to start us off. A bank robber, who's not a rocket scientist, put a pillowcase over his head to hide his identity during a robbery, then had to take it off because he forgot to cut eye holes in it. An imam in Uganda has been suspended from his religious duties after he unknowingly married a man. Obviously, he's asking all the wrong questions. And finally, after finding out that 3 out of 4 British pet owners play music for their animals while the owners are away, Spotify has made playlists and even a podcast for dogs to listen to. So, hey, Rover, thanks for listening. Be sure to tell all your friends to listen to Money Talk. In the studio today of Mark Amateas, Steve Giles, Tom Papenfuss, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, this is definitely a week for the people and not for the dogs, Max. It was a rough week for stocks overall, with the NASDAQ giving back 74 points or 0.8%. The S&P 500 down 34 points or 1%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 1.2%, losing 170 points today to close at the bell at 28,990. For the year, NASDAQ still up 3.8%, the S&P is still up 2.1%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average still up 1.7%. So overall, a good couple of weeks to start the year, but obviously a rough week this week. The 10-year U.S. Treasury moved significantly lower this week, starting at 1.82% and closing today at 1.68%. And that's a quick look at the week. You know, obviously, I think the major concern, especially today, that drove stock prices lower was this, what's potentially being billed as a coronavirus epidemic now in China, and certainly some cause for concern as it's spilled over now to a couple of patients here in the U.S. We've seen, you know, the risks in the past of what things like SARS virus did in 2003, causing Chinese stocks over the course of just about a month to trade lower about 10%. You know, when you look at the economic impact of SARS, it was something like 1% a quarter for a couple of quarters while that was going on. And now, important to note that we got all that back shortly thereafter. And so, you know, maybe it was a temporary pause in the economic growth and not really an ultimate loss of that growth as we just delayed it into future quarters. But, you know, I think a lot of that concern now is on everyone's minds as we come back to an environment where, you know, all of a sudden we've got a new somewhat unknown virus right now, and some reasons to think maybe this time around is a little bit different, but also, you know, some reasons why our clients might be asking us about it, certainly some reasons why the market's down. You know, first and foremost, any of you around the table heard that question yet about what this might do to portfolios, what it might do to stocks, and then I think more importantly, how do you answer that question?
Kyle, I haven't had the question yet, but depending on how this goes, we might. I think the SARS virus was also a coronavirus, but I think it kind of relates to something that we've talked about here in the show, Bob talked about in the seminars back in September, and that is something leading to a crisis of confidence. While the virus itself might not be that big a deal, the thought that it could grow into something that is a big deal could potentially have the effect, depending on how things go, of getting people to maybe, you know, consumers to pull in their horns a bit, businesses to be more careful. Sometimes those things have a way of snowballing. And when something leads to a crisis of confidence like that, that often can precipitate a worse crisis, if you will, even leading potentially to a recession. But right now, I think that it's a non-event at this point. You know, the market's always looking for some reason why the market went down today, why it went up, you know, the other day. And in the long term, that's really immaterial. It could become something concerning, but at this point, you know, it doesn't appear to me to be that big a deal.
And I think, Kyle, you and I were talking before that, you know, you cited SARS going back I think it was around 2002, 2003. A lot of the reason why that had such a broad negative impact was the reaction of China. I mean, we're, you know, a decade and a half beyond that point now. And, you know, China at that time had, you know, waited 4 months to report to the World Health Organization once they knew it was a major, major thing that was happening. So, you know, that is something that is going to have a, you know, much more surprise effect and be a lot more negative. And this time around, China's really got their hands around it within a week, you know, I guess, you know, based on how it's being reported. So, you know, it's reasonable, as kind of Mark is suggesting, to think that, you know, maybe it won't be quite as big of an impact. And, you know, the way it impacted the economies and the markets back, you know, in 2002, 2003 was, it was all pretty short-lived. I mean, it happened initially, but within the year, I mean, markets had recovered, the economy had kind of come back.
Well, keep in mind, too, that what happened back then, Tom, is also different than what's going on now. Because China did react so swiftly, I mean, they've basically locked down a city of 11 million people. So in the short term, we may get some kind of reduction in productivity. If you know, I've been reading articles that the streets are absolutely empty in this city under lockdown. So in the short term, maybe we have a blip in productivity. Longer term, hopefully, if it helps to prevent the spread of what could be a very contagious disease, maybe they made the right decision. But imagine the population over there right now trying to struggle with not knowing exactly how this is going to play out.
Yeah, Steve and Tom, I think your comments kind of point to Mark's point about a crisis of confidence. And the difference between SARS was that we weren't confident that China had any clue how to handle that kind of situation. They'd proven they weren't willing to admit what was going wrong or even that something had gone wrong. And so now to see a very different response, that they've been, I think, very proactive, that they've, you know, certainly been out ahead as much as they can of this. They're building a 1,000-patient hospital to deal with this issue and planning to build it in what sounds like it'll be a couple of weeks, which, you know, you'd never be able to accomplish here. But with the labor they have and with, I think, some more lax laws on building, sometimes you can get done in a country like that. But then I think the other critical piece here, and this is the, I think, the more investment-prone piece here, the piece that I think might be of a bit more benefit to investors is nowadays, unlike back in 2003, we can get the full DNA sequence of a disease like this in a couple of weeks. And so you look at the impact of what that means. It means we can better treat diseases like this. It means we can better find ways to prevent the spread of diseases like this. And those are opportunities for drug manufacturers. They're opportunities for soap makers. They're opportunities for, you know, the medical products field, because we're going to know better how to treat this disease than we did previous. We're going to know better how to prevent it. And so as we look at the continued technological innovation, you know, to me, that's an area of potential investment. Right now in particular is, you know, some company's going to come up with some solution for this particular problem or a number of solutions for this particular problem. And those are areas that we never would have spent on before that never would have been an investment opportunity that are now. You know, I think you look at kind of, especially at the start of a year like this, and yeah, we're a couple of weeks in, but still plenty of papers coming out on what the expectations are. You kind of look at the outlook for this year and beyond, and I think the first thing that comes to my mind as I talk about kind of what we expect this year is the likelihood that the Fed, for most of this year at least, keeps rates about where they are. They've been fairly accommodative in recent quarters, certainly, and that's expected to continue. They're going to meet next week, and really no expectation, you know, that they're going to do much with rates other than talk about how they're planning to stay the same. And so, you know, as we go around the table, certainly I think the Fed, maybe with earnings and interest rates being what matters for stocks and interest rates being the piece the Fed has some say over, with the Fed really unlikely to make many moves. You know, yeah, stocks are expensive. We've said that for a couple of weeks now. But, you know, I think the Fed has given us some ammunition, certainly.
Yeah, I think one thing, Kyle, is, and we've talked about this again, with a lower interest rate, you can justify higher price earnings multiples on the market. And one of the opportunities, too, may be in overseas stocks. You know, for over a decade since the financial crisis, the U.S. market has been outperforming other developed world markets. So speaking of valuations, you know, if you're looking for better valuations, You take a look at overseas. You always should have a balanced portfolio. You should always have a reasonable exposure to overseas markets. But depending on where your portfolio is at, might be time to take a look there.
Yeah, and I think we look at things like the global slowdown. We look at things like Brexit. And Tom, I know that's something you've looked at a little bit recently as reasons why maybe we've been a little bit hesitant to move there. Just a number of reasons why there might be some additional uncertainty. But, you know, I think we've seen some clarity there. And Tom, you know, at least with the Brexit piece, I know there's some signs that maybe things might work out.
Yeah, I think, you know, the theme of 2019 was, as you say, uncertainty. And so now a lot of those things that were major worries of companies, CEOs, CFOs, was, you know, how is the China trade deal going to go through, and what might, to a lesser extent, what might happen with Brexit. And so as Mark pointed out, you know, if you are someone that is in that kind of group that's concerned a bit about domestic stocks and, you know, the great run we've had, we've all enjoyed, but now earnings are getting a bit high, and now we need, I should say, price-to-earnings ratios are getting high, and now we need earnings to support that. You know, we've got, looking at manufacturing numbers, now that some of these you know, the Brexit deal looks like it has some, you know, it's not fully completed, but it has some, you know, so taking some steps down the path towards coming to a resolution, you know, obviously that uncertainty gets alleviated. And so keep in mind that, you know, as much as the Chinese and the U.S. trade deal didn't necessarily impact us that much directly, you look at the Chinese, our trade deal with China and the impact and what the European nations, they're a lot more involved in international trade. So it's a, you know, of all the European Union, about more than half of their revenues come from trade with other countries. So when you've, again, taken away some of that worry, it frees that up again. And so there's reasons to be optimistic about the potential for growth there. And as we've kind of seen with manufacturing numbers, they've started to bottom out a bit, it appears, or we're hoping. You know, at least the slowing has kind of slowed down, to for lack of a better word. And again, there's reasons to be optimistic that you can kind of look overseas.
Yeah, and Tom, there are some indications that the pie is going to get bigger, too. The International Monetary Fund is forecasting in its latest forecast that the global economy is going to grow at a 3.3% rate in 2020, and that's up from 2.9% last year. That 2.9% was the lowest growth rate for the global economy since the recession, since it went negative. And they're actually looking for 2021 to actually be even better than that 3.3%.
You know, and Joel, I think we look so often at the economic data here in the U.S., it's easy to get access to that stuff, and we report on it pretty regularly. I think important to point out, you know, kind of following along with what Tom said, when you look at the surveys of purchasing managers, not just here in the U.S., but globally, we had gone through a period really over the last year and a half, where things had been slowing pretty dramatically. And finally, at the start of 2020 now, those surveys starting to show signs that maybe we're seeing things bottom. In the case of the U.S., the U.K., Japan, actually seeing some growth in those PMI surveys. And those are, I think, a critical piece to global trade. They're a critical piece to so much of whether we get to that 2.9 or whether we get to that 3.2% global GDP growth, because you are going to need to see things stabilize a little bit in order to get to that higher number.
And the EU has been preparing for this for a while. They have taken into their contingency the fact that they had no idea what Britain was going to do. And as much as we've got a hard date here at the end of this month, Europe has moved on already, whether they know what Britain is going to do or not.
Yeah, such a good point, Steve. I think, you know, so much of this already been baked into the cake, so much of this already been priced into stock prices, and then yet I think you look at, you know, how cheap, you know, some of the rest of the world looks relative to the U.S., and even pricing in a lot of those issues, it only takes one piece of good news, one surprise to the positive, to get a little bit better returns than we're expecting outside the U.S. You know, I think we look here within the U.S., and obviously valuations have been one of the talking points of the year. It might be the year of valuation. It might be the year of, you know, maybe stretched prices of things being a little expensive. And yet, you know, when you start to really break down what areas look expensive and what areas look, I'm not going to say cheap, but I'll say less expensive. And you really can see a pretty significant divide, Mark, between growth and value. I know that's something that you've looked at. I wonder what thoughts you have on kind of that spread between growth and value right now.
Yeah, Right, Kyle. You know, growth stocks have been outperforming value stocks for years. And we've quite honestly been overweighting growth stocks reasonably for years. And so that's worked out very well. We still expect growth stocks to do well, perhaps continue to outperform value, but maybe not by as much. But when you look at value stocks versus growth stocks and you compare the current price earnings ratio on each one versus their historic 20-year price earnings ratio, you find that growth stocks are at about 121% of their average price earnings ratio over the last 20 years. Value stocks are at about 112. So there is definitely a difference there. As you said, neither one is cheap, but value is less expensive looked at in that manner. So, you know, that says that there's probably is some catching up to do between value and growth. And then the other thing, when you look at it globally, it's maybe even more extreme. By the year, the end of this year or the end of last year, global growth stocks traded a price to future earnings ratio of 22.8, while value was 13.1. So a real big disconnect there. Much better valuations on value stocks globally. So again, something that is worth looking at.
And I think as big as that difference is in relative terms, right, what's the valuation relative to historical averages, you also have to factor in that historically growth stocks have supported a higher PE. And so if you look at the 20-year average for growth, it's 50% higher than the 20-year average for value. So we're more expensive on a higher number to begin right. with. And so that, you know, to me urges even more caution. It's a conversation that certainly I've had with clients, and I'm sure you've had with clients as well, is how do we pull back or where do we pull back if that's what we want to be doing right now? If we feel we're a little too aggressive, it isn't necessarily selling stocks and buying bonds. It might be just selling the riskiest stocks you have, which more than likely right now is the thing that's done the best the past few years. And so, you know, as you look at your portfolio, that's something to keep in mind.
And that's tough for investors to do. You know, you kind of it's a human nature to think that the way things are going is the way they'll continue to go. So you need to try to get out of that mindset and be ready to be flexible and change when it's time to change.
Yeah, and understand that we can de-risk portfolios without completely abandoning the stock market, that you can make those shifts and take a little bit less risk and experience a little bit less volatility, especially what, you know, I think most people are afraid of, which is that downside volatility. Who cares if your portfolio is up a whole bunch? It's when it's down a whole bunch that you worry. But you can, I think, remove some of that risk without having to abandon the plan entirely. And I think one of the biggest things that we can do to help navigate that risk is move away from strictly looking at kind of the index approach to investing and start to look more at maybe some managers or some approaches that are not just trying to navigate, can I match the return of the index, but what can I do to keep risk in check in this portfolio? And so, you know, we talk about it pretty regularly on this podcast. You look at fixed income and the number of ways that you could buy bonds. Yeah, there's bond indexes out there, and you can buy them pretty cheap, but it's pretty easy to beat those indexes when you look at how vast the bond universe is. You factor in you know, that in, within the stock market, yes, it's difficult for the average manager to beat the index. When all you're doing is factoring in return, when you factor in that we care about risk as much as we care about return, and oftentimes more, there's a lot of active managers out there that can, I think, navigate those issues. And so, you know, I think certainly welcome any comments that any of you have on the topic, but, you know, I think most critical for our clients to understand is that in addition to, you know, making those changes to de-risk portfolios by going from growth to value, by going from stock to bond, we're also looking at ways to keep risk in check by finding managers that are risk conscious, not simply the index.
I think we've seen two things that I can kind of point to over the last, you know, in this bull market over the last 10 years or so that have kind of, you know, I think almost start to make a case for, you know, active managers and looking towards, you know, strategy that, you know, takes into account risk. And, you know, one of those things is when, you know, we've seen in a roaring bull market, it's very easy just to buy the market, and the market, you know, continues to go up, and we kind of have a momentum strategy there. But, you know, it's been talked about of late that, you know, when people are kind of thoughtlessly or mindlessly just buying the market, they're not caring about what the company is that they're buying, you know, the valuations, you know, how much they're making, which is kind of a big deal, you start to get price distortions. And at some point when, let's say we get a crisis of confidence, as you say, Mark, and we start to get some volatility mixed in, and maybe the outlook isn't as rosy it has been, I think you're going to start to see those managers outperform. There's going to start to see those price distortions unravel, and it creates great opportunities for active managers to go out there, because you need a team of analysts and researchers to go out and find those kind of gems.
And remember, too, when you buy an index and investors start liquidating, they have to liquidate that index in proportion to the fund, to the stocks within that index, with no regard to, hey, I ought to hang on to this company. This one's doing really well, and just sell this one. Whereas an active manager, if they start getting liquidations from their fund, they can pick and choose which stocks they feel are pretty fully valued, get rid of those, hold on to some things that they think are a bigger bet. So I think you're right, Tom. In a market such as this, especially, active management usually uses to show its worth.
Yeah, I think the further along we get in this expansion, the older this bull market gets, the more important it's going to be to pay attention to not just, you know, how big is the company in the index, but how quality are their earnings? You know, is this a thing that I want to hold long term? What do I think it's worth? So plenty of reasons to, I think, be a little bit more conscious of what it is we're holding right now. Joel, a pretty quiet week for economic news. You know, some data on housing this week. Anything...
But we basically had three indicators that I looked at: the unemployment claims, the economic leading indicators, and then a report from the National Association of Realtors about existing home sales. And they all kind of combined to tell a story that we keep repeating week after week. The unemployment numbers show that the economy, the labor economy, is still really strong, which is enabling consumers to spend. Consumers provide 70% of our economic growth, as opposed to those countries in Europe that Tom was talking about before that rely on 50% from other countries. You know, we rely so much on our domestic consumers. So when those consumers are feeling strong, one of the things that we're seeing them spend money on is housing. We had record mortgage lending in 2019. A lot of that was refinancing. So people are finding other ways to use their money and to get more money, and their consumers overall are pretty healthy right now in the U.S. And one way that shows up is the housing market, and we have all of these are volatile numbers, but the realtors' numbers this week, you know, they look pretty good for the month of December. And then you put into that though the leading economic indicators, which looks at 10 different economic indicators each month, and it was down for the fourth time in 5 months. But what the conference board, which conducts that survey, what they indicated was that it's the consumers that are really kind of still the backbone, and they're seeing, even though there's been a drag on things in the economy like manufacturing, that consumers are strong enough that they're seeing that, you know, we're still going to have continue this record expansion of the economy, and they think that the GDP is going to be growing about 2% or so this first half of 2020.
Hey, Joel, I think that's why that mortgage lending number struck me so hard. I mean, first of all, a direct result of falling interest rates, that so many people would go out, $2.3 or $2.4 trillion in mortgage lending, the highest number since 2006, and they think about a third of that was refinancing. So many people going out and refinancing. Of course, the other two-thirds is people who are buying homes, new home loans, not refinancing. And certainly we saw that a little bit in the housing numbers, especially early in the year last year. But signs that the housing market is strong. But then that refinancing number is money that, instead of going to the banks in the form of interest payments, is being kept by consumers, and oftentimes consumers that are the most likely to spend it.
Right. Yeah, hopefully they're not keeping it. That's what the economy wants, is them to spend it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, as you look at that number and go, okay, if every one of those people is even saving a little bit on those interest payments, every one of those refinances, that's money that then shows up in retail sales. And it shows up in the 70% of the economy that we really count on for growth. And so, I'm encouraged by what that number means, not for what happened last year, but what it means for those consumer balance sheets and what it means for spending as we look at kind of 2020 and beyond, that's a 15 or 30 year loan that all of a sudden now is more affordable than it was a year ago. So that's a big deal. You know, obviously quiet week this week for the economic piece, but a couple of critical things coming out next week. Obviously we'll hear from the Fed, which we mentioned a little bit earlier, but then we've got the first estimate of GDP. We've got some more housing data, Joel. Anything in particular that you're looking forward to?
Those are the main things. We also have some numbers on durable goods orders, and that's where we'll see manufacturing. And, manufacturing numbers for our economy tells us more about the global economy. That's where that really shows up a lot in economic indicators. So we'll be looking at some numbers from that to see if we're seeing what some of these other purchase managing indexes in other countries are seeing, and that's that the manufacturing recession is getting a little weaker.
Well, as we're putting this together, I think the Bucks are playing in France, and we've got a big Marquette and Wisconsin game tonight, so plenty of basketball to watch for the sports fans out there. We thank you for listening. We enjoy doing the show, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.